Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. Nigeria's ruling All Progressives Congress unveils Kashim Shettima as the vice presidential candidate and partner to former Lagos Governor Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu ahead of next year's general election.
Nigerians are divided on this matter. While the Christian community, both in the Middle Belt as well as in southern Nigeria, have kicked vehemently against this,
the Trade Union Congress in Ghana calls on the government to abolish Article 71 of the Constitution.
The gap is too wide, and you have MPs and mayors and other CEOs have been placed under what in Ghana we call Article 71 holders. And these guys are not in the normal single spine salary structure.
And South Africa's Minister of the Presidency says the government is implementing new measures, including infrastructural projects, to jumpstart the economy.
The Reconstruction and Development Program is a huge program. It deals with localization of manufacturing, reduce the transmissive nature of the pandemic, and also build infrastructure in a blended fashion.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Security analyst says the Malian transitional government and the military must provide protection to civilians following the recent attack on an army base outside the capital, Bamako. The military blames a group linked to Al-Qaeda, Katiba Matina, for the assault. It says the rebels attacked the Katib military camp using two cars packed with explosives. Some have expressed concern the recent decision to withdraw French troops may embolden the militants to launch more attacks. For more reaction to violence, I reach Malian security analyst Aristide Sidibe.
Malian are by large surprised by the audacity of the attack, because that main military barrack is basically in the outskirts of Bamako. And in the last few weeks, there have been militant attacks around the capital city, but it was a little bit farther from the main base. So this one today is really getting to the level where a lot of Malians are becoming to be worried.
Some people are suggesting that if they could attack an army base, then no Malian civilian is safe, even in the capital, Bamako. How do you respond to that?
I mean, this is, and I've been thinking about this the last 24 hours. And if you recall, when President Bush was in office, one of his main political advisors used to say that when you go after your adversary or your enemy, you go after his strength. The last few months, last 10 months, there have been talk about the increased operational capacity of the Malian armed forces. And this being a bragging right for the transitional authority and by large, many people in Mali. So those militants, they also read news. I believe that they are going to after a soft target up to today. But today was very audacious. It means that they are really getting to the level where they think they have enough strength to go after the Malian army.
Do you think that the recent pullout of forces from France is enabling these militant groups to launch these recent attacks?
Personally, I don't, because the Barkhan operation, which is the French operation in Mali and in the Sahel region, been in the process of pulling out for the last 6 months. And yes, a lot of people are making the case that without the French military support, Malian armed forces will not be able to sustain those attacks. But I should remind folks that the French army had been in Mali for 10 years, and the security situation was concentrated in the northern part of Mali, around the region of the province of Kidal. And by the time the French announced their pullout, it was spread all the way to the south. So I'm not convinced that France pullout would have, or France being in Mali would have prevented this.
Has the military assured the population that they will be protected following this audacious latest attack on the military camp?
This remains to be seen, Peter, to be honest with you, because, I mean, this is, like you mentioned, this is very audacious. The military, the transitional government is very popular in Mali. Now, I'm pretty sure there will be question about how prepared the armed forces are to defend the civilian, but this clearly will raise a lot of questions. It remains to be seen how the armed forces will react in the next hours or a couple of days to reassure the civilian.
Aristide Sidibe is a Malian security analyst. He spoke with me from Houston, Texas. In Nigeria, the ruling All Progressives Congress has unveiled Kashim Shettima as the vice presidential candidate and partner to former Lagos Governor Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, the presidential candidate in the February general election. Shettima is a banker and a former governor of Borno State who has also served as a senator. The choice, however, is coming under criticism since both Tinubu and Shettima are Muslims. It has been an unwritten rule to have a Muslim and Christian candidate during federal elections due to the prominence of the two main religions in the West African country. Critics say the Muslim-Muslim ticket will worsen tensions in the country following recent abductions and murder of Christian clerics by Islamic militants. But supporters of the ruling party say the choice of Shettima was based on competence. For analysis and the latest political development, I read Jide Ojo. He is a columnist for Punch, a major newspaper in Nigeria.
Nigerians are divided, opinions are divided on this matter. While the Christian community, both in the Middle Belt as well as in southern Nigeria, have kicked vehemently against this, the Muslim community have been very welcoming of the idea. And even the moderate Christians said there is nothing bad if only we could have competent standard bearer. And competence should be of greater consideration than religion, ethnicity, or tribe. So that is just the two broad perspectives of this issue. The Middle Belt, where you have the Christian minority Christian groups in the north, as well as southeast and south, are majorly against it.
Some people are suggesting that this is a strategic choice that could significantly boost the presidential prospects of Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu. Others are saying it's a self-inflicted wound which could cause his defeat. What is your take?
Well, I believe in the former than the latter. I'm a Christian, but I'm actually indifferent to this Muslim-Muslim ticket. Even in my column in the Punch last week, I wrote about this. Seeing the emergence of Atiku Abubakar from the Northeast and the belief that a majority of the northern, core northern Nigeria will most likely vote for Atiku Abubakar, particularly the Muslim in the north. The only way you can neutralize its influence in the north is by having another Muslim coming from the northern Nigeria. And that, of course, that will anger the Christians in the north and, in fact, in the south. But when you look at the demography of Christians in the north and those who are likely to vote for a Muslim-Muslim ticket, you'll find out that APC has made the right choice.
Some people that I spoke with in Nigeria say that at the time where Nigeria is experiencing a lot of tension, especially between some Christians and Muslims, particularly in the north due to escalating violence in parts of the north where some Christians are being targeted and killed and kidnapped in some instances, the unity of the country should play paramount to just winning the presidency. And that the choice of Shettima as the vice presidential candidate could exacerbate the tension.
What is your take, briefly?
That's the fear the Christians have, that Kashim Shettima has been fingered as being seen a sympathizer of Boko Haram, although that has not been proven. They also believe that given the religious tension, for instance, in northern Nigeria, a number of Catholic priests have been abducted and killed. We've had Deborah Samuel in the College of Education in Sokoto State, who was stoned to death by classmates and by schoolmates over what they termed blasphemy against the Holy Prophet. And this happened just like 2-3 months ago. So these are the tensions that if we have a Muslim Christian ticket right now under the Buhari presidency, and all of these are happening, how much more if we now have a Muslim in the presidency? And this is a cause for concern for the Christian community across the country. But I believe that if APC could do a confidence building across the religious leaders and give guarantees about safety and security of people of minority ethnic groups as well as minority religious groups in the north, that their rights and privileges will be protected, perhaps that will cancel trade bans. But right now, it generates a lot of tension. In fact, I learned reliably today that some lawyers have even gone to court to ask for the nullification of the nomination of APC on the basis that it's not reflective of a federal character principle as enshrined in the Constitution.
Jide Ojo is a columnist for Punch, a major newspaper in Nigeria. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Still in Nigeria, the Academic Staff of Universities, or ASU, says the government must sign and implement an agreement with the group before its members will return to the classroom. This after local media reports quoted members of the government as saying the administration plans to resolve outstanding issues with the group within the next 2 weeks. The ASU embarked on a strike on February 14 after saying the government has failed to keep its promises since negotiations began several years ago. Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke, president of the Academic Staff of Universities, says the group will continue the strike until government meets all of its demands. They include the revitalization of public universities, increased funding for state universities, and the payment of promotion arrears and allowances. Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke tells me that his group remains focused on its objective, which he says is to make the country's universities competitive with those in wealthy countries.
The history does not give us the confidence to say because you have promised 2 weeks we should call off. The history does not, because you have done that so many times and didn't do anything. That is why we are insisting that this could be done within 1 or 2 days. But if they say 2 weeks, we'll wait for the 2 weeks.
Is there any engagement ongoing to try to resolve this in 2 weeks, as the government says?
On our own side, we have finished everything. We met with the government negotiation committee set up by the government. We have a draft agreement waiting for signing. So when they come to sign, we are waiting for them to come to us to sign, and then we'll sign. We're also waiting for their report. If this can be done within 2 days, and then the issues are over. So they should do what is needed within 1 or 2 days, and then issues are resolved. So that is where we are. So it's on their side. We are just waiting.
Professor Shodeke, some supporters of the government are saying you are being unreasonable, especially when the country's economy has been battered by the COVID situation and the ongoing invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and that it should give the government a little leg room to get the economy going before meeting some of these demands you've made. How do you respond to them?
It is very clear. This strike started before the Russia invasion. This process of bringing our universities in line with what you have in universities all over the world started as long back as 2009. This negotiation started in 2017. There was no problem with Russia. So what we are saying is that if this government, who say we should not, we should just wait, can afford to bring out 4 trillion naira for the so-called fuel subsidy, we should not be, you can't be, you have a country that will be producing crude oil since 2005, and you say by 2021, 22, you don't have a single refinery functioning, which means dereliction of duty. But you can bring 4 trillion to subsidize fuel subsidy. You can bring 200 billion naira for feeding of children in school, which nobody sees. Nobody says, well, who is being fed? So when you have all this, we believe that it's the interest that matters. And if their children were in Nigerian universities, they would not be telling this thing they're telling the world. Let them bring Nigerian their children to attend Nigerian universities, and then we'll believe them.
Some have even accused the ASU leadership of not caring for the students who have been sitting at home. They said the students could even be attracted to joining bandits or even being recruited by Boko Haram militants. And that should fall on the head, not only of the government, but also of the ASU leadership. Your response to them?
Thank you very much. In the 70s and early and 80s, it was the students that were fighting and struggling for the to ensure that Nigerian universities compare with universities in the world. You heard of Ali Monsgo when they do lots of things. But today, the students, instead of fighting for their rights, they are busy accusing Nasu, who is fighting for them. The government insisted in 2017, the panel they set up that every child should pay school fees of 1 million naira as tuition fee, which one of the issues that have prolonged this strike, that have prolonged this struggle. Maybe the students are ready to pay 1 million naira as if they agree they want to pay 1 million naira as a tuition fee, then we can allow them to go and we'll withdraw the strike. They should go and tell the whole court, tell the government that they are willing to pay 1 million naira as school fees. Then we'll call off the strike. You see, what we are fighting for is not about the present set of students, but about the Nigerian university system. Go to the U.S. university, you see many Nigerian professors, lecturers who are teaching. You see Nigerian doctors who are teaching. How many Americans do you have in Nigerian university teaching? Why are Nigerians leaving and nobody is coming? That's the question we ask ourselves. Why are the big men sending their children using our own resources to foreign universities? Why they allow the children to suffer in what look like university, where students sit on bare floor or hang out the window to have lecture? So that's what the students should look at.
So Professor Shodike, what does ASU want to see from the government to say that indeed we are ready to finalize everything and return to the classroom after news that you've heard that they want to resolve this within the next 2 weeks?
The government set up a team of trusted people, pro-chancellors, with a mandate, a written mandate to negotiate on its behalf. And that committee has finished renegotiation and came back to you, say, give up permission to sign. And you are telling us you are going to wait. That was in June 16, more than a month. As I speak to you, I asked one member who has not been paid for 24 months because of this so-called IPPIS we talked about. So once this country, Nigeria can produce a payment mechanism for all workers in the country, we don't need a foreign one. That is it. So when they agree to do all this, we call out the check.
Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke is the president of the Academic Staff of Universities. He spoke with me from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. In Ghana, the Trade Union Congress, or TUC, a group that represents public sector workers, is calling on the government to abolish Article 71 of the Constitution. The provision enables the payment of large amounts of money as retirement packages to senior government officials, including members of parliament, legislature, members of Council of State who advise the president and CEOs of state institutions. The call comes after civil society, public sector workers and a section of the population said the payments are unfair and demoralizing to public sector workers. They also say it is unreasonable to pay a large amount of funds to public office holders who routinely serve only a short time and some, such as the Council of State members, work only part-time. It also follows reports that the government is attempting to negotiate a bailout with officials of the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. For more on the call for the removal of Article 71 of the Constitution, I reach Ernest Boateng. He is the national organizer of the Trade Union Congress, or TUC, in Ghana.
We think that in terms of inequality, the gap is too wide. And you have MPs and mayors and other CEOs have been placed under what in Ghana we call Article 71 holders. And these guys are not in the normal single-spine salary structure. They are not. So, for instance, if you look at our pension system, we have somebody in Ghana who receives 140,000 as a pensioner. And then another person, the least of it, receives about 300 Ghana cedis. Look at this gap. In their working life, how much were they receiving? They go on pension and receive about 140,000 Ghana cedis. The unfairness is too much. And the TUC believes that this system must not continue. It must end from now. We impress on government, work with government to ensure that we have a system that is so, or is beneficial to all.
Eric, a lot of Ghanaians have questioned why the TUC is calling on the government to suspend or scrap the entire unfairness of Article 71 holders. Why is the TUC hot now by calling on the government to scrap it?
So we are social partners, and we have worked with the review of these pension laws over time. So, of course, the pension law 766, we always say that even the journey to hell may have good intentions. But so our ideas were that those laws had good intentions. But over time, we have seen that it's not providing the benefits we need for our people. So if we make laws and we think that at a point in time, the laws are not serving the interests of Ghanaians, we need to change it. And that is where the TUC is coming from. This country is sick. We need to find a solution to it. And we work with government to be able to provide that solution.
What has been the response of the government since you broached this idea about reviewing this Article 71 title holders of public offices?
The point we are making is that, for instance, last year we mentioned to government that we want pension top-up for pensioners. And the president at our trade union headquarters used that platform to say that he has directed for a top-up to be paid to pensioners. Up to now, as we speak, it has not been done. Are we saying the president is also not giving, is not going by his words? These are issues we are talking with our social partners, and we think that we must raise them. We have asked for the labor law review for 3 years now. It has not been done. You see, when TUC will start coming out like this, we think that then things are not well. These things are good. I mean, we are a social partner. We continue to work with them. But you see, if you give advice in the quiet and it's not being heard, then you bring it out so that we all find a common point and see how we can address these issues.
If the government does not adhere to this call for the review of, one, the labor law and Article 71 title holders, what will be the action of the TUC? Because I understand a lot of Ghanaians are really displeased with the how some public sector workers are paid with huge sums of money while the others can't take anything away. Meanwhile, these people, like the members of parliament, those who are the executives, get a whole lot of money, and other public sector workers get minimum or no money at all.
Already, the Secretary General has indicated that the TUC will not sit down for any government to move Ghanaians into so much hardship, and that we are prepared to lead Ghanaians to resist any attempt by any government to put us into those hardships. But the point is that, in terms of actions, I want to mention that when anybody wants to go and commit suicide, and keeps on saying, I'm going to commit suicide, then he needs an intervention. We want somebody to stop him from committing it. If we want to do it, we don't need anybody to stop us. So we will not put our strategies out there for anybody to know. But we are. Anytime we speak like this, we are throwing caution that it is time that government gives us the needed attention on the issues we have highlighted.
Ernest Boateng is the national organizer of the Trade Union Congress, or TUC, in Ghana. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. South Africa's minister at the presidency says the government is implementing new measures, including infrastructural projects, to jumpstart the economy. Mondli Gungubele says the initiative to build back better after COVID is a move that creates the enabling environment for the government to partner with the private sector to help create job opportunities for the country's youth. Gungubele led South Africa's delegation to the United Nations High-Level Political Forum, which ended in New York this week. Officials say the conference aims to provide political leadership, guidance, and recommendations on the implementation of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. For more on the efforts by South African government to jumpstart the economy, I reach Mondli Gungubele via Skype.
The pandemic was the most unanticipated monster, and very proud by the manner in which we're able to confront it under the leadership of this president and be able to survive as a nation still intact, but also exposed a lot of fault lines in terms of the state of socioeconomic infrastructure, access to water, access to sanitation, and even our people still congested in a number of settlements. Post it, the Reconstruction and Development Program is a huge program that we are following. It deals with localization of manufacturing. It deals with the COVID, reduce the COVID, the pandemic, or the transmissive nature of the pandemic, and also build infrastructure in a blended fashion, and also make sure that the small SMEs find themselves in a less regulated environment so that they can unleash their power, because history has demonstrated all over the world that SMEs are the most resilient structure in an environment that is conducive, where they are able to deal with affordable cost and be able to make margins.
So talk to me about how South Africa is currently doing regarding the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals. And what do you think South Africans should expect from this implementation? How that will impact their lives, I mean.
For a long time, we ignored the infrastructure. And having analyzed that, we need to use infrastructure as a key lever to turn around the economy. And against the background of a limited fiscal space, the president introduced a blended finance approach, meaning that we create conditions where both government and the private sector, on major strategic projects, we actually contribute money. And then what government does, put 100 billion over 10 years, the importance of that is to unlock private sector money on a great framework of operation. And we got a huge response from the private sector. We are able now to say no less than 314 billion is actually already committed to project, blended between the private and the public finance. And the other element which became very key, because in a situation where your fiscal space is limited, you need private sector to do more. And it became clear that to unleash their resources, we need to make sure that we dilute the strictures in the economy that make it easy for them to invest, so that the cost of our economy is reduced, so that business people are able to make money. So in other words, we were able as a result to actually list areas of structural reforms, improve a turnaround on our rail infrastructure, a turnaround on our communication, releasing the spectrum so that we reduce the cost of data, and improve what we call water licensing.
What is the time frame for you to actualize this infrastructural reforms that you seek to implement or you are implementing?
The transmission of the effect from infrastructure is not a very quick fix. It takes time. But the advantage you have, especially if you invest in what we call industrial networks, in other words, mobility, communication, water, and all those infrastructure plans, that when they are in place, communication will be affordable, cost of movement will be reduced, and water will be accessible, secured, and the fourth industrial network being the energy. So we are focusing in those areas. Immediately you've got a plan around those areas. You have business people already planning for the planning predictably, knowing what is going to happen in the mid and long term. So it's difficult to say in 6 months or in a year, but in a short time as best as possible, because we have to demonstrate our commitment to the plans we're adopting. All what you need to private sector, they must say this can be predicted in 10 years, 5 years to come. They start now planning around you. And then the tendency is, once that confidence in the predictability of economy is secure, private sector start investing now. Remember, they know what to do to unleash the economy. All what they want is an infrastructure within which their economy can sustain in long term.
Mondli Gungubele is South Africa's minister at the presidency. He spoke with me via Skype from New York. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni has appointed an opposition leader, Norbert Mao, as the new Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs. Mao, leader of the Democratic Party, the oldest opposition party since 2010, was a former critic of the administration. The appointment came a day after he signed a cooperation agreement with President Museveni. But Mao is coming under criticism from members of his own party in parliament who accused him of betrayal. They say the agreement signed with the government is not binding. Other opposition and civil society groups also say he has betrayed his colleagues in the opposition who seek to wrestle power from the government. Some analysts say his appointment is a strategic victory for the president. For more reaction to Mao's designation as new Justice and Constitutional Affairs Minister, I reach parliamentarian Medard Segona. He is a lawyer and former member of the Democratic Party, but has now joined the National Unity Platform.
Norbert Mao is qualified for the job at a personal level. I think he has been long in politics. The only difference is the inconsistency with which he has conducted himself. For a long time, Norbert Mao has been telling the country that President Museveni is a bad man, he is corrupt, and so many things in that generic string. What surprised us yesterday was the cooperation agreement they signed. And one would ask, you are now cooperating to do what? Are you cooperating to further the human rights abuses that Mr. Museveni has subjected Ugandans to? Are you cooperating to further the corruption that has marred our country's politics for the last three decades? Are you cooperating to further tear our constitution into pieces, especially now that he's been appointed Justice and Constitutional Affairs Minister? So that one leaves many questions hanging. Secondly, he is at liberty to cross and join the NRM as a person. But what shocked many people is how he decided to go and bind a political party whose organs have not taken a decision to join Museveni.
Some people said, why not, if he can contribute his quota to strengthening the judicial process to make it more independent and fair to all Ugandans?
First of all, whoever pays the piper sets the tune. The person who appointed him minister does not want a strong and independent judiciary. Secondly, their choice was to negotiate how to share the executive cake. It has nothing to do with the judiciary, because what does the Minister of Justice do in strengthening the judiciary? I see no role whatsoever, because Museveni is the minister for everything in his cabinet.
How are other opposition folks reacting to this? Because some, I understand, are displeased with it. Some are saying that the agreement that he signed a couple of days ago pretty much gave him the platform to be chosen as the Justice Minister, while others are saying that he really betrayed the opposition who seek to wrestle power from President Yoweri Museveni. How do you respond to that?
First, on the face of it, he has been calling himself opposition, but he has not been opposition. I think everything that he's been doing for the last 10 years has been to undermine the opposition and our effort at taking power from Yoweri Museveni. If you notice, in the last two campaigns where he participated as a presidential candidate, he shifted his attacks from the ruling NRM to the opposition. In 2011, his attacks were directed at Dr. Kizza Besigye, and in 2021, his attacks were directed at Honorable Robert Ssentamu Kyagulanyi Bobi Wine. So he has been, I think, informally working with the NRM. What happened yesterday was only formality. They were simply formalizing their relationship. So I don't think we will miss him. Of course, we only suffer with the fact that he occupies the position of president general or president of a political party in the opposition. And by doing what he has done, the intention and purpose is to, and has been to, divide the opposition. Unfortunately, we will not be divided, because I believe 90% of the Democratic Party leadership is not with him.
Now, what do you say to those who are saying that this is a master strategic stroke by President Yoweri Museveni to pick somebody from the opposition as justice minister, and that he is trying to reach out, to be engaging, to accommodate fresh ideas, even from the opposition, to try to build up the country? How do you respond to that?
If he wanted to do that, he would have consulted the entire opposition, and would have discussed as matters of principle and not individual satisfaction by provision of jobs, by provision of money, etc. If we all wanted money, we would have had money from President Museveni. If we wanted jobs, we would have jobs from President Museveni, now that he seems to be the alpha and omega. Our stand is simple and clear. We want Uganda to change. And Uganda does not change by appointing one, two, or three of us ministers. For example, how is the appointment of Norbert Mao going to solve the question of corruption? How is the appointment of Norbert Mao going to solve the question of hunger and starvation, especially in Karamoja and other parts of the country?
Medard Segona is a lawyer and former member of the Democratic Party, but has now joined the National Unity Platform. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. At a recent ceremony to pass one of the most significant federal gun safety legislations in decades, U.S. President Joe Biden decried the increased gun violence in the country, saying it has turned everyday places in America into killing fields. Studies show that gun violence disproportionately affects African-American communities, many living in poor neighborhoods in places like West Philadelphia, which has experienced an increase in cases of fatal shootings. VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi visited a shooting victim in Philadelphia and brings us this report.
As the wave of horrific mass shootings dominate daily news in America, the issue of gun rights and the Second Amendment continues to be part of a heated national debate. Statistics show that across the U.S., there has been an uptick in the number of victims of gun violence. The rates are especially high in urban areas, with large cities like Philadelphia setting an all-time record for homicides last year. And figures show that even though we're halfway through the year, 2022 is on pace to be the most violent in the city's recorded history. West Philadelphia, or West Philly, is what some urban experts would refer to as an inner city. It is also home to a thriving Liberian-American community. David Bonney, who we first met in 2015 in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, on my trip to cover the Ebola pandemic, moved to Philadelphia 5 years ago to continue his college education. He works part-time as an assistant manager at a local Rite Aid. And even though gun violence in his neighborhood has been featured on the local news, he was too busy with work and school to pay close attention to it. That changed in June of this year when David, walking home in the early hours of a summer morning, was confronted by a gunman a few meters from his home.
I was shot six times, and I got, like, multiple wounds in my leg. Some of the bullets penetrated my leg, and one of the bullets got stuck within my muscles. One of the bullets also fractured my femoral bone and also my femoral bone right here. And then one of the bullets also cut one of my veins in the back of my leg.
David says that he was lucky that none of the bullets hit him above the waist.
That's the fascinating part. I really don't understand. How did those bullets get, you know, all the way down there and not up here? But thank God it didn't hit me up on my upper range. But, you know, I'm very grateful. I'm really, really grateful that I'm alive.
Like many African immigrants, David did not think too much on the issue of gun violence. He says that he felt that that was more of an American debate.
We Africans, we really try our best to stay, you know, just stay very quiet.
Out of trouble.
And out of trouble. Because, you know, that's how we're raised. We stay out of trouble. We just work very hard, you know, take care of ourselves and our families.
Reports say that in the U.S. this year, each day on average, over 300 people are killed by gunshots in multiple forms of violence, including assaults and murders. David says that one of the lessons from this traumatic experience has been to dispel the stereotype that all young black male victims of gun violence in inner cities are always gang members or somehow connected to illegal drugs.
My hope and prayer to the world, to America, and the rest of America, I would love for you guys to understand that every young black man is not the same. You cannot put everybody in the same category, because some of us are strong young black men. We work very hard. We're intelligent people. We work very hard to build our communities, to make our communities a better place. And if something like this happened to me or other young men out there, all the victims out there, the police should take the time to investigate. The police should be able to at least be in consultation with the families of the victims.
As David hails from his auntie's house, 20 minutes away from his old neighborhood, he hopes that police will continue following up on his case and possibly catch the shooter. But with the increasing cases of shootings in the area, that is likely to be another statistic of an unsolved shooting. For Voice of America, I'm Jackson Bunganyi.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Hey, uh-uh. Don't sleep, wake up. Kalaya money, Kalaya money. Sweet, wake up. Kalaya money, Kalaya money. Wake up. Tera, 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 go get the mula. Wake up.
I'm a young bee, I'm a cow. La lela, si estás en el sol, Adin Yashake.
I'm a logo, but it's so cool. Gbogbo ìṣòro rẹ ọ̀tá ní oko. Ẹnu ẹ ò ní gbẹ ò ní mọ́fò. Ọmọ yìí kò ọpọlọ lọ fi ń gbégbò. Ṣé o no like designer? Àbí you no like to gba pa? Ibigi lágá ti gàgà yìí dá sùn ṣọ́pẹ́ tẹ̀. Ẹ sì bí àìná. Palazzo jíjì gbọ́jà kò lè rízi. Kò tó sleeping, ọmọ ló ń dọ́ni. Gba ọ̀pẹ́tì kíákíá ọmọ yárin. Máì jí o ṣàmọ̀ yárin. Mo dìbẹ̀ bàtàwọn dárin. Ẹ bá mi lè ṣàárín. Come on, come on, come on, come
on. One, two, three, come on.
Popping at the para, really lobby. As you can see, for overseas, and find Mr. Money all over, be the money. It's going, cause so she, you love me. Boba Gucci, Versace, but then you say, ooh, Bauteku, but you say, ooh, come on, dog, or pull a little bit.
Here we go.
My last of
cheating,
but y'all could be sleeping, I'm on a journey,
music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the mouth that eats Pepe is the one that Pepe influences. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.